that it's a little bit lower in performance, because when he's got the switching arrangement in the shack, and he can flip back and forth between horizontal and vertical, while receiving in particular, there are times when a guy fades out to your horizontal antenna, and even though your vertical antenna is lower in performance, you flip over to the vertical, and there he is. He's not faded out. So if you've got the resources, and if you're enthusiastic enough, eventually you're going to put up horizontal antennas, vertical antennas, wire antennas, ground plane antennas, Yagi antennas, rhombic antennas, beverage antennas. You're going to fill up your backyard with wire. And don't worry about it, because for the most part, the general population, the rest of those, you know, one ham per 500 in the population, the other 499 people, most of the time do not see wire. When they're walking along the sidewalk, they look at the panels of the sidewalk where they're walking, and they look at the fences and the buildings and the telephone poles around them. They don't look up in the air and say, oh, there's a guy that's got some wire on his roof there in Lindenhurst. Very rare does that happen. Yeah, when you first do it, you make a great big noise out of it. Let me drop. You make a great big noise out of putting up the antenna. You got an antenna raising party. You got a bunch of guys hooping and hollering in your backyard. And now they know to look that something is happening. But if you quietly put up a bunch of wire at dusk, if you know what I mean, for the most part, people don't see it. And what's the best polarization? The one that works best for you. And no matter which one works best for you, build the other one. Lou is saying that. I am saying that. And there are times when it gives you an advantage. Over to you for any further comments on this one, Lou. And 2IJC, K2RIW.
Okay, that's it. I was actually talking about man-made noise. Sometimes it's you can get rid of it by switching polarization. But yeah, absolutely. When the signal is fading, flip back and forth, and a lot of times it's better than the other way. But man-made noise is sometimes tough, and usually man-made noise is horizontally polarized because of the wires out in the street. Sorry about that, but difference in polarization sometimes makes the difference. Back to that N2YJC.
Yeah, the wires in the street are horizontal, and common sense would lead you to believe you're going to get more horizontal signal. Depending on your particular antenna, your environment, whatever, there are people who see more noise vertically. So it's different at different times. I think that's the main points I wanted to make. I think there was one other point which I can't think of right now. So good luck with that installation, Angel. What I'm going to do right now is turn it back to Angel for his any final comment. He asked the original question. Then we're going to go over to Mel's mailbag, because it's 9 o'clock. And then we're going to go over to Paul's space report. And then we're going to go over to John's sensitivity question, which is a goodie. Back to you, Angel. And I know we went far and wide from where you asked, but hopefully some of this information is going to be helpful. And when you do put up that antenna, please come back and tell us what you did and how well it works. KC2, Echo Romeo Romeo, K2RW. You got it, Angel.
Yeah, the information was good. Okay, so my last question is, I have a project that's going to come up in the summertime, which is it's a weather balloon with a dipole. I'm looking to do 2 meters and HF. I'm looking for some information on that. It's going to be with a weather balloon, maybe 60 feet up in the air, and some guy wires holding it up, and it's a V configuration of a dipole. Or it could be a horizontal dipole, one or the other. It could be V or horizontal, all depends. But I'm looking for some suggestions.
And you probably said it, but I missed it, Angel. You're going to be using the weather balloon on what frequency? I think you said 2 meters, but run that by again.
It's going to be on, well, I never did it before. I just thought about it. I'm looking for HF and 2 meters.
Yeah, what you're about to discover is that on a calm day, a weather balloon allows you to have a sky hook in the up in the air to either hold up an inverted V antenna or a dipole or a ground plane, all kinds of antennas you can put on a balloon. And yes, the guy wires will keep the balloon on station. But as the wind blows more than, let me pick a number, 15 miles an hour, you're going to find out that the guy wires pulling on the balloon will make it lay almost parallel to the ground. So on a windy day, unless you've got a very fancy aerodynamic-shaped balloon, a balloon on a windy day is a tough thing to do. So you might want to make sure you've got a backup technique for doing that. On top of that, you go to the right website. Let me drop. It will tell you how many cubic feet of balloon or what diameter of balloon is going to give you how much lifting power. And you're going to be disappointed. The amount of hardware that the balloon can haul up in the air, which in the case of 2 meters or on any of those frequencies, you're going to be hauling up a transmission line that's got quite a bit of weight, the antenna itself, and the guy wires, the tethering. You add that all together, the total amount of weight is such that unless you've got a pretty darn big balloon and a lot of helium, you're not going to get anywhere near as much lifting power as you think. So go through those calculations before going out there on a field day site and having this great big disappointment because you can't get it up in the air because you're trying to lift too many pounds of stuff. So those are your biggest problems as I see it. And I'd like to believe there's an article somewhere telling you where other people have used a balloon. In the case of a 160-meter ground plane antenna, you set up the balloon at a beachfront. A couple of people have done that. It works very nicely. But you got to make sure you've got a bleeder resistor in the system because it'll pick up a static charge that can sometimes give you quite a bit of exciting events, if you know what I mean. Good luck with that project. I know we haven't answered the whole question on the balloon because I don't have a lot of smarts on that one. I hope there's some articles on that one. Let me give a quick drop and see if anyone else has got some balloon experience they want to give us. Give me your call letters right now, K2LAW in the TechNet. I heard BATL Deco Lima Kilo. Extremely noisy signal. Unless you can do something to make it stronger, I don't think we're going to be able to.
Whiskey Bunroy Echo Lima Kilo.com.
Whiskey Bravo 8 Echo Lima Kilo.com. Whatever that means. Oh, okay. Whiskey Bravo 8 Echo Lima Kilo.com. Very good. I'm hearing you on the input. I'm not hearing you through the machine until I got that. So, okay, so there is a website with real balloon information. There you go, Angel. Whiskey Bravo 8 Echo Lima Kilo. Yeah, I know that some of those guys in Ohio were doing quite a bit of balloon operations. And so there's a lot of experience there. And some of these guys with FAA approval managed to fly balloons at very high altitudes, sometimes untethered balloons. So it's going to give you some more of the information you're looking for. Good luck with that, Angel. I'm going to go over to Mel now, and hope we haven't had any of those strong emails this week, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Good comment, Dick.
Go ahead, John.
Dick, Angel might want to try experimenting with some small balloons and the amount of cubic helium he's going to be using to get the lift factors. This way he can calculate basically what size balloon he's going to need. So, over to you, sir.
Yeah, in the case of a balloon, though, it is a science. You tell a man who is sufficiently smart how big is the balloon in cubic feet, or how big is its diameter, how heavy is the balloon itself, and what percentage of the inside is going to be helium versus air. You can calculate that ahead of time. If you know the size of the balloon, the amount of helium versus the amount of air, you'll know, you know, with 90% accuracy, 10% error, what is the lifting power of that going to be? And yes, to then go and see it yourself by really doing the experiment is a fun thing to do. Mel, K2KEY, K2RIW.
Roger, this is K2KEY. We're seeing some of those launches, and the balloon gets to be quite large because, like you say, the drag on it between the antenna and the wire sending down and all. So I got to do some real fancy work there and get. It's not going to be launched by one of these balloons that you get at a birthday party, literally. I'm just reading over here what I can read. Let's see. Not too many comments about anything other than that was last week. Thank God that's all dropped off. Let me let it drop it. I think maybe we can go through this one. Okay, here's one. I've seen this one before. I think we may have given some answers, but basically, let's see if I can boil it down. It gives me quite a bit of information here. The schematic of my mobile radio for installation in the car says that I have to fuse both lines. Why is this have to be done, and what is the reason? I can understand fusing the hot side, but why do I have to also fuse the cold side at the battery, which is recommended both a fuse in the battery positively as close to the terminal as possible, and also one at the negative terminal? What is the reason for the negative terminal fusing? I don't know if we can like get him an answer to the stick over.
I guess my first answer, Mel, is belt and suspenders, to be double darn sure. Also, because you're adding those two wires and you're insulating from the chassis, I mean, it's very tempting to run one red wire from the positive lead of the battery over to your radio, and your radio is not that far away from the sheet metal of the car in many cases, and you just simply ground the radio. As far as electronics is concerned, you've completed the circuit. And in theory, the radio is going to work. But there's a catch. You've now introduced great big unbalanced currents into the sheet metal of the automobile, in the frame of the automobile, and there's a reasonably high chance it's going to give you some kind of grief when it comes to the emission control computer, the computer that gives you the indications on the instrument dial, and other things. You've got a whole lot of computers in the car. And the only way you can really keep those computers happy is to shield them from as much of the RF as you can and as much of the high current capability, particularly if you're running something like single sideband. Let me drop.
KC2QIQ with a comment.
We'll go over to Glenn in a minute. But if you run a twisted pair of red and black heavy-duty wire from your radio, not grounding it anywhere, per se, running it through the firewall of the car and then over to the battery, and now you've got this twisted pair of wires with a fuse on the red lead and the black lead going to the plus or minus lead of the battery. You've now got about three advantages. Number one, you've got the greatest amount of voltage with the least amount of drop going to your radio. You're going to get the most amount of performance out of the radio. Number two, the biggest filter capacitor your car has is that battery. You're going to get the least amount of alternator wind. Number three, you're not launching a whole lot of unbalanced currents into the frame and the sheet metal of the car, which are going to disturb the living daylights out of the computer. You'd be amazed how many guys run a simple red wire over to the battery, over to the radio, and then ground the radio locally to the frame of the car. And every time they transmit, the car speeds up, slows down, stalls, and the instrument panel goes crazy. So for a bunch of reasons, you want to do that. Now, because you're adding this wiring, which is not factory done, and hopefully you're doing a nice, careful job of the grommet where the wire goes through the firewall, because you've got to really worry about the fact that if either of those wires cuts through the insulation by the sheet metal that's nearby and grounds one of those leads, life's going to get complicated. If you ground the red lead, hopefully you blow the red fuse, the red wire positive fuse. There are various techniques by which a short can occur somewhere else in the car where positive 12 volts is being applied to the negative wire, and you want to make sure that you open up that circuit. So to be double darn sure, I think you should have a fuse on both the positive and negative lead. There's one slight disadvantage of that, and that is the fuse does give you a little bit of voltage drop, and now by having two fuses, you're going to have twice as much voltage drop. When it comes to the nice automobile install...
Repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
When it comes to the nice automobile installation you've done, Glenn, tell us how you've done it, and what's your feeling on the right way to wire this. KC2QIQ, K2LIW in the second hand.
Comment also, Dick.
John recognized. You got it, Glenn.
Yeah, good evening, Dick. Good evening, Mel, and John, everybody else on the net tonight. I believe the reason for why most of the manufacturers supply two fuses with the for the radio installations, and it's mentioned in a lot of articles, is because at one time there were a lot of vehicles, and there are still some till today that have positive grounded systems. So, in today most of the standard here in the United States is negative ground, but some of the other installations that can be available to somebody, and even some marine applications, will have a positive grounded type of situation. So even though you're wiring back to the battery, because of that reverse polarity, it gives you that capability to have the protection right there at the battery to open up the fuse in the negative end. That's my understanding of why most of the manufacturers supply the two fuses. And normally, you know, in a lot of cases, especially with the high power stuff, I'm usually guilty of just putting one in the positive side, Dick. Back over to you. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Good information. There's a man who's been there and done it. Lots of automobile installations. If you're a Limoc member and you see last issue of the Limoc log, he's got some nice pictures and schematics of what he's done for his automobile installations. John, KC2WGB, what's your suggestion on all of this?
Just lastly.
KC2WGB. Dick, the main reason for that fuse on the negative wire is in case you lose the ground strap on the battery. Now you'll have, if it's mounted to the dashboard, you'll have the car, the ham equipment, returning a lot of current on that ground lead, and they do not want that. That's done on a lot of installations like that, and that's really the main requirement, the reason for that. And that was a great article, Glenn. I told you that already. Back to you, Nick.
Yeah, another good solution. So, for a bunch of reasons, you're being double darn sure, belt and suspenders, so to speak, to put a fuse in both wires, except for the tiny little bit of extra voltage drop you get with the fuse in the negative lead. You come out with a lot more safety, so I recommend doing that. Well, your next one, Mel, K2KEY, K2RIW.
Yeah, this is K2KEY. Yeah, that's the best suggestion of all, is because if the ground side fuse is there really to protect the radio, if the heavy wire, say, from the battery ground, let me make it a little clearer for those who listen, if the heavy wire, say, from the battery ground to the engine block, is not making a good connection, say, because of, who knows, loosened up corrosion. The next time you go to start the vehicle, the ground side fuse weren't there. In other words, it was direct. The starting current will try to flow through the radio ground system. And I don't think that would be ideal. So that's really a good suggestion why they put give you both fuses. I don't think they explain it in the article, Dick, so I believe that may be the main reason. While I'm reading, do you want to make a comment? Go ahead.
Yep, there's a lot of good reasons for fusing both. There's a lot of good reasons for running a twisted pair all the way back to the battery. Don't skimp on that wiring if you want a good operation with your automobile radio, your radios, that you install, your ham radios that you install on an automobile. And that gives you the best possible shielding from inducing extraneous signals into your computer system. There's a bunch of sensors on that engine. I'll bet you there's about 30 different sensors that feed that emission control computer. And you don't want to induce crazy extra currents by doing anything but those two wires from your radio. Your radio may, in some cases, draw 20 amperes, and you want that to come directly from the battery and not flow through anything else in that automobile if you can possibly avoid it. No other engine part, no other body part, because you could be goofing up those sensors and making and giving false alarm signals to that computer. And my car did something funny today, and I don't quite understand why. I've got one of these code readers, and it said there was no errors. But for the first time in the 3 years that I've owned the automobile, it wouldn't start. And I did quite a bit of cranking, and then I started coughing a little bit, and then it would run but keep stalling. The only way I could keep it running was to put the accelerator a quarter of the way down. And after I kept it running for about 30 seconds that way, then I let my foot off the accelerator for the fourth time, and now it didn't stall. Now it kept right on running, and the condition, whatever it was, completely cured itself. As if the computer decided to reset itself, so to speak. First time in 3 years of owning the car that did that. A buddy of mine had that happen to him, and it really was a failure of the sensor that looks at the position of the crankshaft, and he had a
repeater, timeout, cancel.
And he had to replace that sensor, and that wasn't a pleasant replacement. Hope I'm not running into that. This is a 1999 Toyota Camry, I think it is. Okay, Mel, what's the next one? K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, I'm looking for one. Okay, here's this one. Does wrapping coax in a coil outside of my house help in lightning protection? Yeah, that's a good question, making a coil and putting it outside. I can think of yes and no on that, Dick. Go ahead.
Most of us, when we coil up the coax, we're doing it near the antenna as a high-power, poor man's ballon. By ballon, I mean you take an ordinary piece of coax cable and you decide to feed a dipole with it, and the center conductor you connect to the right-hand side of the dipole, and the shield you connect to the left-hand side of the dipole. The dipole might have 70 ohms of impedance, 72 ohms of impedance, between the left side and the right side of the dipole. What we keep forgetting about is that that dipole, the left side has got something close to 36 ohms to space, and the left-hand side's got 36 ohms to space. What I'm saying is that you try to feed that coax cable across the dipole directly. The dipole tries to balance itself such that if 100 volts is coming out of your feed line, it thinks that there's a positive 100 volts on the center conductor and a negative 100 volts on the outer conductor. That's what it thinks. That's what the dipole thinks. And the net result is you're going to be shipping, if it's 100 volts, should have been plus 50, minus 50, but you know what I mean. 50 volts in my example of RF energy would be flowing down the outside of the coax because you connected it to a balanced antenna. So by putting a coil of wire, a coil of your coax cable, 3, 4, 5 turns, a couple of feet in diameter, near the antenna in HF purposes, held together with tie wraps or whatever, let me drop. You're creating an RF choke. And now that current that tries to flow back down the outside shield of the coax cable encounters the inductance of that coil of coax, which becomes a quasi-open circuit, and the current doesn't flow down any further. So for balancing reasons, to make sure you don't have RF in the shack, to make sure you don't have RF on the outside of the coax, we usually will, in many cases, put a coax coil near the antenna. If you put the coax coil near the house, you're not getting that benefit. You still have that RF energy flowing down that whole length of the outside shield of the coax cable. So when it comes to antenna performance, it's not going to buy you much at the house. When it comes to lightning protection, almost everything we do with lightning arresters and whatever, we try to make from the point where the lightning is going to touch the antenna, the lightning arrester, the upside-down metal broom on the top of the chimney, whatever, the tower, we try to run a nice heavy lead as straight as possible to a good earth ground. And by, now to take the opposite of, approach, to try to choke away the lightning, let me drop... To try to create an RF choke on the bottom of your feed line, hoping that the lightning will now not continue to flow through the feed line, it'll jump to something else because you've got that coil of wire there. It's not the recommended procedure. Is it a better approach most of the time or only some of the time? It's an interesting question. I think I'd rather see a whole lot of other grounding techniques of the antenna and to create an RF choke. Even if you do create that RF choke and you do it on the feed line of that antenna, if, for instance, that feed line is going up the tower and you've got a bunch of other coaxes going up the tower, you've also got the cable that's giving commands to the rotator. You may have a B-plus cable that goes to a low noise amplifier up there if you're a VHF person. Are you going to run all of those wires through the exact same choking mechanism? That's a tough way to go. I think you're better off using other grounding techniques. I'm not going to say it's not going to work. I just don't think it's going to give you the benefit you're looking for most of the time. That's my feeling on it, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
KC2QAQ with a comment.
Glenn recognized. Mel first. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay. Well, you know, because in a couple of places that sell, you know, antenna supplies, one of the things that they offer is the ferrite common mode choke, which to some extent they say helps to, you know, limit the problem with lightning. So instead of rolling the coax up out, what do you think about putting those common mode ferrite type chokes on the line, Dick? Over.
When it comes to our ferrite expert, that's Glenn. He's going to be, for two reasons now, he's going to be talking to us in another 30 seconds. I doubt it. A lightning bolt consists of, let me pick a number, 10 million volts and 13,000 amperes. And you're going to put some finite chunk of ferrite that you can hold in your hand across your coax cable, around your coax cable, and you want that thing to hold off 10 million volts and 13,000 amperes. If you think your chunk of ferrite is going to do that, I'm going to sell you a piece of that bridge in Brooklyn that I also own. I doubt it, Mel. It's got too little space to hold off anywhere near that amount of voltage or amount of current. I will admit it gives you some protection of the electromagnetic pulse that's coupled onto your coax cable when a lightning strike occurs three blocks away and some magnetic field gets picked up by your wiring. Yeah, in that case, I think the ferrite's going to give you some protection. But on a direct hit where you need it the most, I think you're not even spitting in the ocean, if you know what I mean, and trying to measure the increase in the tide. I just don't think that ferrite can do it. Let's see what Glenn thinks on this one. KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, Mel, I've seen this kind of approach for a couple of different reasons that people have tried it, and it's usually for EMI reasons that people have tried it. For lightning, it's going to do nothing, realistically. It won't hold off anything. The way that charge builds up onto a good ground system, the ferrite won't do anything. But here's a warning for putting inductance in series with grounds. If you have any kind of impulse noise, sharp currents turning on and off, bleed-off currents from rotator motors and other things, when that current will be slightly delayed going into that inductor, if something turns off abruptly and you have somewhat of an open circuit, you can create very, very large impulse voltage spikes that are due to that added inductance. And if you have a lot of series inductance with the ground and you have these impulses of currents turning on and then turning off, you can create some pretty, pretty large spike voltages that can get back into some solid-state equipment that could actually destroy components. Back over to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ. But common mode in the feed line or, you know, coming back into the shack outside of the regular grounding is still fairly good practice. But that's not the same as, you know, inductance in series with ground for lightning purposes. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
By the way, when it comes to feeding a dipole, and if coax is your favorite kind of transmission line, although it's a little bit elaborate, consider running a pair of transmission lines, running it as shielded twin lead. If I'm running a pair of RG8U cables that come from the same roll so that they're both electrically the same velocity factor, and I put the two coax cables side by side and shield, connect the shield to shield, so the shields are all together, and now I've got two center conductors to work with. It really is shielded twin lead. And I run the right-hand center conductor to the right-hand side of the dipole and the left-hand center conductor to the left-hand side of the dipole. That's a very handy way of giving a balanced feed with coax cable to a balanced antenna, even though the raw materials you've got, the coax cable, is basically an unbalanced device. You can force it to be balanced. Be careful, though. You don't fall into a trap. A buddy of mine did. We got into a great big discussion on this one on Thursday, and I finally brought him over to my point of view. He thought because half the voltage is going down each cable, that the overall loss of the system is going to be lower. I said, no way, Jose. You've got a power divider that's feeding the two coaxes at the shack end. Let me drop.
I love it.
So you've got half the power going to each one of those coax cables, and each one of those coax cables has got some number of dB per 100 feet. And the fact that there's two of them there doesn't change anything, in my opinion. Each one's still going to give you the same number of dB per 100 feet. and when the signal comes out to the antenna end, you're going to take those two AX cables. In theory, you can put them back into a power summer and get back the exact same power. So each individual piece of power going down the cable, even though half of it's going down the left-hand coax and half of it's going down the right-hand coax, the dB per foot is the same. And he was telling me that, well, each one's running at half voltage, and power is E squared over R, half voltage is one quarter the apparent amount of loss, and he came up with a bunch of hairy mathematics leading me to believe that he's going to come out 2-to-1 ahead by using a pair of cables. He's going to come out 2-to-1 ahead when it comes to voltage tolerance, you know, how high a voltage you can go before he arcs over the cable. I'll give him that. But when it comes to insertion loss, you got to be careful. dB of some length of cable, it's going to have that number of dB, whether you've got one lead there or 40 leads there, if you know what I mean. And you divide up the power by 40-to-1. If that would work, lots of people would have a 40-to-1 power divider and 40 pieces of cable, and now all the loss would go away, and you've got a lossless piece of cable. A little too good to be true. K2KEY, K2RIW. Go ahead, Mel.
Case, this is K2KEY. Yeah, there's one more question. I just seem to get lightning questions. All of a sudden, there's questions about lightning and things like that. Here's one. I have a tower that is located about 75 feet from my house. Would I be better off to bury the coax as it comes down the tower to the house? Is it better for lightning protection to bury the coax rather than run it overhead? Okay, that's a good question. Go ahead.
I just happen to have a tower 75 feet from my house. And I made double darn sure that there is a pair of 6-gauge wires. From the north side of the tower is one of the wires, and the south side of the tower is the other one of the wires, going into an 8-foot-long grounding rod buried below grade. So right at the tower itself is where the grounding is most important. So that the signal, when lightning strikes the tower, it goes down the tower and goes into that local ground and doesn't get a chance to build up a great big voltage on your cable. I think the difference of overhead cable versus grounded cable, I think the difference is small. I believe there's a slight advantage on the underground cable because there's more of a chance for any great big chunk of signal that decides to go down the outside of your coax, it can jump over the ground on that buried cable as opposed to the overhead cable. I think there's a slight advantage, but I think the advantage is small, and the real lightning protection is the local grounding at the tower itself. That's my feeling on that one, Mel. You've got a couple of towers on the property. How did you do it? K2KEY, K2RIW. Eric recognized in that order. Go ahead, Mel first.
Definitely, I've got a very elaborate ground system here. Many rods are down here, all bonded together by number 6 wire, brazed right to the rods and then terminating at the tower. And that's the only way I would have any really security feeling, even though, and especially the soil here, you know, you go down with a 9-foot rod here and you're hitting water. So it provides extremely good ground. I have that. I have the also bonded to the cold water pipe, the main coming in. I have that bonded also to the system and everything. I just got wherever I could come to this point of, you know, of bringing a ground strap, I surely took advantage of it. Let's see. Yeah, I don't believe really that be any significant really in reducing the current reaching the station by burying the coax, to tell you the truth. Okay, over to Eric.
Yeah, I believe the main reason why you would bury the coax or run it overhead is primarily your convenience. If you're bringing the coax into the second floor of the house from the tower, then with a messenger cable and the cable suspended in the air, the overall length becomes shorter, and it becomes a little bit more convenient. So there's a bunch of other things going on. Now, Eric has got a broadcast station with something like 300 feet of tower, and the tower is mounted some number of feet away from the broadcast transmitter itself. I guarantee that the bottom of the tower has some substantial grounding, and his main tower out in plain view is a guide tower. I'll bet you each one of those guy wires has a local grounding system right where the guy wire reaches the ground, And I'll bet you his great big pieces of waveguide that he feeds his broadcast transmitter, his television broadcast transmitter, I bet you they are not buried in the ground. I bet you they come, you know, they go through a trough with an ice protection mechanism above them so that ice falling off the tower doesn't hit the guy wire, doesn't hit the waveguide and dent it. So, and I'll bet you that waveguide comes into the broadcast center in an elevated manner. The real grounding is at the base of the tower, and those the guy wires is my guess. Let's see what Eric's got to say on this one. KE2EJ, KQRIW in the TechNet.
Ah, you're pretty darn close, Dick. By the way, do I have enough audio?
Beautiful, plenty of it. Go right ahead.
Alright, well, at the base of the tower, well, first of all, it's a guide tower, so the tower comes to a point at the bottom. It actually sits on a ball, and it's the guide to keep it plumb. And you're right, each guy actually has his own hunk of ground wire, which goes into a local ground at the end where the screw and the cement hold the guys into the ground. But at the base of the tower, there's 6 25-foot copper rods that are pounded into the ground. And I've been in that transmitter room when it's been hit by lightning. You can't hear anything afterwards because it's very loud. But the transmitters really don't have a problem with it. The one issue that we do get in that situation is that if there is a very large EMP pulse created, depending upon where it hits the tower, I have some audio equipment of all things with FET inputs that is completely isolated from the power system and everything else, and every now and then they'll get whacked from a lightning hit. And it's purely an electromagnetic pulse that does the job. The lightning does actually, even though it's going to ground, transmit is fine with transmitter. It has no problem. Even at the World Trade Center, now that thing got hit maybe 10, 15 times a night right by the antenna. And don't forget, those antennas are actually at DC ground. I had one transmitter which goes directly into the standby antenna without going through any cavities. And that bloody thing, once in a while I'd lose an output thermal system because of it, but that was pretty rare. Let me let it drop. But even there, the expanding electromagnetic field from the lightning hit sometimes will it'll induce a voltage in something that makes it feel not very nice and not very happy, even isolated from everything. So that's one issue. You're incorrect as far as waveguide. Yeah, we've got ice bridges everywhere, but when we had the analog transmitter, you know that big waveguide, we actually made a transition to 6-inch coax, and the 6-inch coax goes up the tower, but still you don't want to bend that stuff. KQRIW, KQJ.
Now, because you've got such very good grounding at the base of the tower and at each one of the guy wires, when lightning strikes the tower, the real discharge through air, which creates a whole 13,000, 50,000 ampere arc through the air gets heated brighter in temperature than the surface of the sun, and the expanding air, when you're off miles away, gives you this great big rumble that you and I call thunder as a result of the lightning. When you're in your broadcast center in plain view, and you're directly below that tower per se, and most of that lightning bolt is above you, straight above you, 300 feet, my guess is you don't hear the same kind of a rumble. You hear a kind of a clack, a high-frequency sound instead of a low-frequency sound, and I presume what you're hearing is the acoustics of what's taking place 300 feet above you. I'd like to believe there is no substantial electrical discharge in the broadcast center itself. That's a bunch of guesses on my part, Eric. And speak a tiny bit softer. A little bit of distortion when you bang against the sides. KE2EJ, KQRIW in the TechNet.
Now, the interesting thing is you more feel it than you hear it. The air pressure below you changes a lot. It's like a compression hit, so to speak, because the air pressure actually changes around the building, which is interesting. and it's not a rumble. It's a crack. It's one loud jabang, and then you're done. And the kind of stuff that I'm talking about that gets whacked is, you know, like MOSFET inputs, or a lot of the audio stuff has op amps with FET inputs. So some of them, you know, you get maybe 15-20 volts induced on a line, because you have these long audio cables that go into the other building, and they act like antennas, even though they're shielded and the stuff is balanced. It doesn't like voltage, so, you know, that kind of stuff happens.
Now, my guess is you've got a couple of interesting hair-raising stories about what has happened on a thunderstorm day at the World Trade Center, building number one, the northern building, where you had something like 330 feet of tower on top of something like 1,250 feet of building, and that is a beautiful lightning attractor. My guess is you've been in that broadcast center, you've been in that transmitting room on a couple of occasions when lightning occurred. When lightning strikes that main mast on that building, what happens in the transmitting room? What happens in the rest of the building? Do the people a couple of floors down feel anything funny? Give us one or two good lightning stories about World Trade Center. K2KEY, K2RIW, good audio.
Once you're stuck in Mount Blue.
All right, K2KEY, Mount Blue. Oh, interesting thing about the World Trade Center, because there's so much cement slab around it. You know, I've been in there one night, I think we had like 12 or 14 hits, and you didn't even know what had happened. It's after the fact that you find out about it when something cooks. Things cook occasionally, but not very often. But I don't think I would want to be on the roof while that's happening. People tend to stay below, so... But as far as the building goes, you barely notice it. I mean, you'll feel it a little bit, but because of the differential in air pressure between the bottom and the top, the air is always, you know, the air is always moving through the building. So even though there's some big compression going on outside, you don't notice it.
So I think you're telling me that to a person inside of the World Trade Center, where you've got the something like 25 million pounds of concrete on each individual floor. I think the concrete was poured something like 6 or 8 inches thick, and each floor is roughly 1 acre. So that gives you a lot of soundproofing. So I think if you're inside the building, you almost don't know the lightning storm is happening. Has there ever been anyone on the roof during a lightning strike? And did he ever any hair-raising stories, pun intended? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Right.
Not to my knowledge, Dick. Although, you know, I could ask around. I mean, a lot of people that used to be there. You know, I'm not talking about like Rod and a few other people that I knew, but a lot of folks have retired and moved to Florida and stuff. So, you know, good stories like that, Dick, kind of hard to come by. I'm not aware of anybody being foolish enough to be on that roof at that time, because not only does it hit the tower, it hits the edge of the best building. Had all metal flashing around it. You can actually go up on the roof and look at the edge and see these big pock marks from rather smelted aluminum from electrical discharges from the sky.
Wow. Wouldn't want to be there at that time. Okay, thank you, Eric. Your choice, Mel, if you think you've got another one, or we'll go on to the space report. K2KEY, K2RIW. Shut up, question.
I'm silly.
Okay, better go on, Dick. Getting late. So pick up Wesley and then go on with the space report.
Go ahead, N2XJN, K2RIW.
Zero. Okay, and to examine, you have the horizontally and vertically polarized antenna Yagi in one antenna, and you feed the transmitter into that. Half of the power is coming to the vertical port, and half of them is that is coming to the horizontal one. From the receiver standpoint, if the antenna is horizontally polarized, then the antenna should receive the signal 3 dB less, comparing to only horizontal one from the transmitter. Two.
You've got that right. So if you transmit only horizontal elements, and you're talking to a guy who's got a horizontal receiving antenna, and he sets a reference power, and now you feed the horizontal and the vertical simultaneously, which means you're feeding half power to each, but he only senses one of those. And whether you do it in phase and give a slant 45 degree polarization, or you do it in 90 degrees of phase shift and you make circular polarization, in either case, he will think you're 3 dB weaker when you feed both. But if now he also has a similar antenna, horizontal and vertical elements on the same boom, and as long as he's using the same polarization characteristics as you, slant 45 in the same direction, or circular polarization, and you're both clockwise, or you're both counterclockwise, now he gets full power, and there is no 3 dB of difference. So when it comes to these circular polarization power comparisons, you have to be careful as to what you're using as reference, and you have to realize that the only way that you usually make circular polarization, let me drop. The way you usually make circular polarization with HF and VHF-like antennas is you're doing it with some horizontal elements and some vertical elements, and you're deciding how much power you feed to each one. If you feed exactly half power to each, and it's exactly 90 degrees out of phase, in theory, you're circular polarized, clockwise or counterclockwise. If you fed two-thirds the power to one and one-third of the power to the other, by definition, you're elliptically polarized. And if the two-thirds the power was in the horizontal elements, you would be elliptical polarized with the major axis of the ellipse would be horizontal. So it sort of follows common sense. You literally can draw with an X and Y chart with a two-dimensional graph. You can draw vectors that represent the amount of power you're putting into the horizontal elements and the amount of power you're putting into the vertical elements. And with that graph, you can figure out what's going on. It's not too different than putting a certain amount of volts on the horizontal plates of an oscilloscope and a certain amount of voltage on the vertical plates. Feed the same amount of voltage to both, and you get a slant 45 degree straight line across the screen. Feed the same amount of power to both, but 90 degrees out of phase, and you draw a circle on the screen. So a circle on the oscilloscope and circular polarization with antennas have a strong similarity. And so with a good oscilloscope, and the signal generators that you own, you could study some of these effects and watch what happens when you change the amplitudes and the phases. And what you see on the screen is very close to what the polarization will be in space. Now, let me drop.
You got to stop that shit up there. Thank you.
What you see on the screen, though, is a circle or an ellipse with a major axis and a minor axis. And they're always at right angles to each other in some particular orientation. And the real polarized wave in space is a little more complicated than that. But still, the oscilloscope screen gives you a pretty good representation of that. Let's go over to the space report. After that, we'll pick up the receiver sensitivity testing technique. WS2N, Paul, what's going on in space? K2RIW in the TechNet.
Shoot me some info.
And by the way, Paul, give me a small transmission first. Let's find out how well you're being received tonight.
Shoot me some info. Go ahead. Go ahead. Shoot.
Yeah, I'm going to go.
Go ahead. Shoot.
Three topics. SDS.
Go ahead.
Boy, that will be taking off in April. Schedule launch. Endeavor will be going up. That's the one that will be taking Kelly up. If it Congress or a woman that was shot. So that'll be a big news story. It would have been big news as it was, because that is the planned last flight of Endeavor. Just like we had the last flight of Discovery. That is now back last week. And that is scheduled. scheduled to probably go to a museum. That's what will happen to Endeavour, and eventually Atlantis. Atlantis will be the final flight. A couple more months down the road. So if you want to bring up STS-134, you drop it. Okay, and want to bring up Messenger. Messenger, this week we'll be going into Mercury orbit, actually on St. Patrick's Day. So right now it's, what is it, 5-6 years since launch. It's trying to slow itself down to get into that 88-day orbit that Mercury takes to get around the sun. And that will be very interesting to see this thing finally make it into orbit. It'll be the first spacecraft to go into orbit around that planet. And it will stay there. It's got enough fuel to do that. It's going to burn like one-third of its weight. It's all fuel. I think at launch it was like over half the amount of weight was fuel. And it'll be burning its rockets for about 14 minutes, slowing it down another almost 2,000 miles per hour. And also using some other maneuvering rockets to help slow itself down. And then it will go into a 125-mile low orbit. The apogee and perigee, I think, is going to be 124 by 12. It's a 12-hour orbit, whatever. It's not going to be a 90-minute orbit like we have here on Earth. It'll be very low and then very high. So it'll be quite elliptical. So we'll be looking forward to getting a lot of good science back from that spacecraft. Another robotic spacecraft, which has been going for, 33 years now, is the Voyager 1 and Voyager 2. And they're still not only commanding the spacecraft to send them information back, but they actually had to turn. They moved it, rotated in space by about 70 degrees. It always faces, has the antenna facing Earth. What they wanted to do is move it, which they did. And the reason for it is testing where the solar system ends. It's looking for the heliosphere. And that was always a theoretical point where the solar wind would meet the interstellar wind. And this big sphere surrounding the solar system, looking for that. And what has happened is, let me drop it, 50 years where the, they've got this detector on board that can detect the solar wind. And they always were looking for when that solar wind would stop its forward direction. Now, the spacecraft is still going away from the sun at 40,000 miles per hour. But they were always looking for this, where it would stop. And it has stopped. In Voyager 1's case, anyway. Voyager 2, it hasn't. So, now the next thing is, they're going to look to see where the waves, where the solar wind is going to be, coming from. If they know now, it's probably hitting the heliosphere and actually coming back. So to do that test, they have to arrange the spacecraft to point in a certain direction, sort of like a wind detector. Where's it coming from? And with that information, over the next couple of years, they'll be able to get some good science out of that when they study it back here on Earth. And this is going to go on and on for a couple of weeks. Drop it.
You got to stop that shit up there.
That's the way. This will be going on for a couple of weeks, making this maneuver. Now, with the amazing. You know, 33 years in space, this thing hasn't moved. It hasn't been commanded to move in 20 years, and it did so without failure. Now, when Voyager 2 gets to its location, when the solar wind is detected not moving, they're going to go through the same process with that. So both spacecraft are working very good, and after all this time. So I thought I'd bring that up. I always like the Voyager stories. Voyager 1 is way above the ecliptic, where all the planets, you've got all your planets, they're like looking down, it's like looking at a record, like an OLP. But where Voyager 1 is, it's way above the ecliptic, you know, going up like 30 degrees, looking back down, where Voyager 2 is going straight out. The reason for that is when they passed Saturn, they wanted to get a good close look at the moon's height. But to do that, they had to change the direction of Voyager 1. Original plans were to have both spacecraft go out to Saturn and then eventually out to Uranus and then out to Neptune. But they decided to only let the one spacecraft do that. Voyager 2, Voyager 1, they sacrificed that for a real close look at Titan. So that's the reason to have this thing way above the ecliptic plane. Back to you, Dick. WS-20, Space Report.
You got it, sir.
Yeah, it's too bad that the solar wind detector on Voyager 1 failed in 1990. But I guess Voyager 2 is still giving us information. I'm taking a quick look now at Wikipedia on Voyager, and I'm trying to find what is the current range. I think it's 39 astronomical units is the distance between the Sun and Pluto, and I believe that Voyager is almost twice the range of Pluto. Is that true, if you remember, Paul? Well, Voyager 1 or 2, which one is further, and how many astronomical units, if you happen to know? Over to you, Paul.
It's further. 11 billion miles out last time I looked, and it's probably, you know, 79-80 AU astronomical units. Yeah, Pluto is 39. So and it's no, the detector's still working on both, the solar wind detector, but it wasn't since 1990 that the spacecraft was commanded to move. They use gyroscopes on board to do this. Both detectors are working very good there.
Yeah, Wikipedia makes the mistake of saying that the solar wind detector failed in 1990 on Voyager 1. I think you're saying because of its orientation, it was no longer picking up signals, and now that they reoriented the spacecraft, it is picking up solar wind signals. Is that what you're saying, Paul? Go ahead.
Definitely is. Anybody can read this because it's one of the main topics that they have on NASA.gov about Voyager. In that literature, you don't see anything about a failure in 1990 in that regard. So as far as I know, according to NASA report, they're talking about it like it was never broken. Maybe it was broken and they brought it back to life, but back in 1990, I don't know. But it definitely is, they're both definitely working, one and two.
It's interesting to calculate how long it takes for a signal to get from the Earth to Voyager one way, and then I think most of the time when they give a command, they tell it, tell me what you heard, and make sure that I know what you heard before I tell you to go do it. Otherwise, something really bad can happen. Because you send a signal that long a distance, a noise spike can certainly get in there. I keep forgetting. I think there's 8 hours of difference between the speed of light coming off the sun and it gets to us. So, 80
minutes.
What was that again?
minutes from the sun to us, and you're looking at a 24-hour, almost 24-hour turnaround for Voyager.
Okay, so 12 hours one way and 12 hours back at the speed of light. We used to think the speed of light is really fast.